Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Even before the economic meltdown, millions of Americans had trouble pulling together enough to eat, enough to be properly nourished. Now, food prices are up, incomes are blinking out, and hunger is a challenge. My guest today, hunger expert Joel Berg, has a plan to meet that challenge. It stretches wider than you might guess this hour on Point Hunger in America and how to solve it. You can join the conversation. What do you know about hunger in this country? Do you see it in your schools, your neighborhood? Have you lived with it? Is your town's food bank getting cleaned out these days? Joining me now from New York is Joel Berg, Executive Director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger. He served in the U.S. Department of Agriculture in the Clinton administration. His new book is All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America? Joel, thanks very much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me and having this vital discussion.
Who's hungry in this country?
There are 36.2 million Americans, including 12 million children, who live in households that just can't afford enough food. They're working families, they're children, they're senior citizens, they're people with disabilities. And I know, Tom, you've lived and worked in other parts of the globe where there are people starving to death, and I'm always quite clear in my book and otherwise that hunger in America isn't quite the same as in Somalia or North Korea, people starving to death in the streets. It is people choosing between food and rent, people rationing food, parents going without food so their children can eat, and the greatest irony of all is people becoming obese because they can't afford the most nutritious food, which sometimes doesn't even exist in their neighborhoods.
Joel, when you try to explain American hunger to Americans, what kind of response do you get?
It is very difficult to explain to Americans who aren't low income that we have hunger in this country. When Americans think of hunger, their mental image is a small boy sitting on a parched piece of ground in Africa surrounded by flies and Sally Struthers. They can't imagine that their neighbor, perhaps even in a leafy suburb, just doesn't earn enough to feed their families. And people assume that because I'm an advocate, I exaggerate. That's one of the reasons I wrote this book and had a few hundred footnotes in it to really document with a great amount of detail that this is a problem as American as apple pie. Yes, we don't have the same problem as Somalia, but we do have kids going through dumpsters to get their morning breakfast. We do have cancer patients who can't afford cancer medicine and food. And when Americans understand that a nation with 400 billionaires also has 36.2 million Americans who can't afford enough food, they are shocked and they do want to do something serious about it.
Joel, we're going to hear a lot about that situation, about your thoughts on how it might be addressed. We're going to hear from our callers as well in this hour, and I'd like to go to one just straight off the top here. Hilton Head, South Carolina. Francis, you are on the air, and we're glad to have you. What do you know?
Thank you, Tom. I love your show. I just want to say I'm 70 years old, and I never thought I'd end up like this, but I had a stroke when I was teaching, so I didn't get any retirement. I live on $12 a week food stamps and once in a while some donations from the local agencies, but every single day I'm worried about how I'm going to eat. And I'm a vegetarian, so I would like to buy soy burgers and healthy things, but, you know, like the man said, sometimes you just have to fill up on, you know, what will fill your stomach, and it's really scary.
Francis, did you say $12 a week in food stamps?
Yes, sir. Well, it averages out that because I get 48 a month.
And what do you buy with $12 a week?
I buy one thing of beans and soy burgers, that's $4, and then a couple cans of beans and some rice, and that's about it.
What about the rest? You must have some other income, Social Security.
I have Social Security, which exactly pays for the roof over my head. That's it. And I get different organizations sometimes to help me with the light bill, or, you know, friends sometimes help me with the light bill, but it's every day it's like scary about how am I going to survive one more day.
Are there times in a month, a week, a day when you're hungry? Are you hungry all the time on $12 a week food?
Mostly, yes, yes. Mostly all the time hungry, yes.
Joel, what do you say to the story that we hear right here from Frances?
Well, thanks so much for the call. And unfortunately, her story is all too typical. Until the recent farm bill, the minimum food stamps benefit was $10 a month for some senior citizens for a month. She's talking about a week. Some were getting $10 a month, senior citizens, some people on disability, some people living in public housing. We marginally raised that. I lived just sort of as a stunt on the food stamps diet for a week here in New York 2 years ago. That was $28.30 for a week. And people said, oh, you're faking it because a lot of people get higher allotments. And the truth is, if you understand what the word average means, if that was average, that means a lot of people get less. And you've heard her story. She worked throughout her life. We have stereotypes in America that people who are poor and hungry somehow are lazy bums who don't want to work. There are a few people who are poor, just as there are the Paris Hiltons of the world who are rich, who may not work as much as we all think they should. But the vast majority of people struggling are working families. And I just want to mention one thing about South Carolina, as I pointed out in the book. It played a very historic role in the growth of modern nutrition programs because the then governor of South Carolina, who went on to become a senator, Ernest Hollings, admitted in the late 60s that he had sort of been covering up the extent of hunger in South Carolina because he thought it would discourage businesses from relocating to South Carolina if they knew what deprivation was there. And he basically said, I can't cover this up anymore. The issue is too grave, and we've got to face facts squarely that we have a problem. And because he was seen as conservative and South Carolina was seen as a conservative state, when a person of his stature admitted the nation had a problem, people really changed their minds and took note, and that helped spur the efforts that created the modern nutrition assistance safety net in the late 60s and early 70s, but obviously they are not robust enough. They don't cover enough people. As far as I'm concerned, in a nation with all this wealth that has perhaps by one estimate $1 trillion for a Wall Street bailout, someone such as our caller from South Carolina should not be struggling with hunger in a nation this rich.
Frances, good luck to you there. I wish we could put a great big soy burger right on your table, but the best we can do here is, right now, is talk it through, but we appreciate your call. Let's get one from your town, Joel. New York City, we've got John on the line from New York. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Yes, good day. Thanks for taking my call. I have a comment, and it's a topic to bring up in the vein of this topic of hunger. During the course of a day, I know what you're addressing is people that are hungry that can't afford to buy anything. But I see people times that are just extremely overweight, and you know they get hungry, or they wouldn't be in the condition they're in. So how do we as a society address both issues, the ones where people who do not have the funds to buy anything and those that are just abusing food and just becoming obese and cannot manage their own weight?
Yeah, John, that is a great question. I'm sure it will hit many people. It'll come straight to their mind, the sort of cognitive dissonance of a country in which we have a very well-known and much bemoaned problem with obesity, and particularly, Joel, among low-income Americans. And somehow, I guess you're telling us that sits side by side with hunger, and it's hard to make sense of that picture, but tell us how you do.
Well, thanks, John. That's an excellent question. For just regular folks, it doesn't make sense that we'd have both hunger and obesity. And as I point out in my book, some people in conservative think tanks purposely exploit that paradox to give the country the false impression we don't have hunger. The truth is, as I document thoroughly, hunger and obesity are often flip sides of the same malnutrition coin for two reasons. Number one, low-income people don't have enough money to buy the most nutritious food. Skim milk is more expensive than whole milk. Whole bread is more expensive than white bread. Lean meat is more expensive than fattier meat. And sometimes produce is far too expensive. Add to that, many low-income neighborhoods, and not just in urban areas, but in rural areas as well, are what we call in the field food deserts, which means you really cannot get fresh, affordable food in those neighborhoods, and particularly you can't even get fresh produce. That's the bad news. The good news is there are ways to deal with this. Here in New York City, with the support of Mayor Bloomberg, who I'm critical of on some other fronts, but on this front, very supportive of the Speaker of City Council, Christine Quinn, they started a program to provide matching funds for people using food stamps at farmers markets. So that's one great way to help small farmers, help fight hunger, help improve nutrition, help reduce obesity. So some people have called for restricting what people can buy with food stamps. I don't support that. There's no evidence that people on food stamps shop any less nutritiously than similarly low-income people. I think a much better response is to expand people's buying options, making sure nutrition benefits are big enough, frankly, creating more living wage jobs so people can buy the nutritious foods they need, and government doing more to help bring fresh produce and other healthy, nutritious foods into low-income neighborhoods at affordable prices.
But if John in New York sees an overweight person on the street, can he comfortably assume that person's okay? They're clearly not hungry.
Look, there are many complex reasons for people being obese or even slightly overweight. I'm not the thinnest guy in the world myself. I ran the New York City Marathon a few years ago and even wasn't particularly thin then.
But you're not starving. You're not hungry.
No, part of it's genetics. My point is that there are a lot of complex reasons, from emotional reasons to genetic reasons to all sorts of economic reasons why people are obese. Sometimes they can be obese and hungry or food insecure. The very, very poorest and hungriest people actually do lose weight. But the next rung above, people are sort of struggling at the edge, are the ones that tend to become obese because they're buying potato chips, because sometimes that's what they can afford and fresh produce isn't there. Sometimes sort of yuppies say to me, well, if poor people just shop better and cook better, and sure, all Americans should do that, but poor people just can't afford or find the nutritious food, so they have extra burdens that we don't have.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about hunger in the USA and what to do about it. My guest is Joel Berg. He joins us from New York. His new book is All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America? Let's go straight to Marianne in Mansfield, Massachusetts. Marianne, you're on the air. What do you know?
Hi, Tom. Hi. My daughter sponsored a family for Christmas, and the only thing, the woman had four children. The only thing on her list was food.
This was a wish list for Christmas presents?
Right.
No iPods,
no iPods, no stereo, no, not even clothes, food.
Food. She just wanted the gift of food for her kids.
Right.
Was your daughter surprised?
I was, even think about it, I get choked up.
Yeah.
Food.
Just food for Christmas. Marianne, thanks. Joel, no iPod, no video game. Everything on that Christmas wish list, food. Where do people go if it's not enough on food stamps? How do people deal?
Well, because food stamps aren't enough and too many Americans aren't getting food stamps, who in my judgment should be eligible for food stamps, they often end up at food pantries and soup kitchens. In this nation today, more than 25 million, that's million with an M, Americans are forced to rely upon charities to feed their families. And as I point out in my book, this network of more than 40,000 pantries and kitchens really didn't exist by the late 70s because it wasn't needed. Back then, we almost ended hunger in America because the nutrition safety net was more robust and because mostly if you were working, you could afford to feed your families. So we really have gone backwards in the last few decades, sold on this false notion that a few underfunded, often uncoordinated, volunteer-run charities could somehow solve a major social problem impacting tens of millions of Americans. I will say if there is one infinitesimal silver lining for this economic downturn, when I did media interviews over the last few years, often people would call up and the focus would be, oh, why are these lazy bums not working? And now two things have happened. Number one, with the Wall Street collapse, we've seen not everyone who was wealthy because they were virtuous and brilliant. Mm. And we've also seen that not everyone who is poor because they're non-virtuous or not interested in working hard. So it's a horrible cost this nation is paying, but sometimes out of the ashes comes some hope, and that is the hope that this nation will collectively wake up to see that the reason we have hunger is that we have more poverty than any other developed nation on the planet, and that we have a collective opportunity with a president-elect pledged to doing something about this to take real action.
Let's reach out, Joel, and hear from that world of food banks from the other coast. Why not today? You're in New York. Let's go to California, Oakland, California, and Jessica Bartholow. She's director of programs at the California Association of Food Banks. She's worked with food banks for nearly a decade. Jessica, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You tell a story about a phone call you got, I don't know, just in the last couple of days from someone who's worked in a local kitchen, someone who's volunteered in a soup kitchen, saying what?
Saying that they needed to find a place to have a meal. And when it came time to for me to give them directions to the location, he said, don't bother. I know how to get there.
Because he had volunteered there.
That's right.
And now he's going to be on the receiving end. What's going on with food banks generally in California, demand and available food-wise, Jessica?
Well, food banks have had a very big impact from the economic crisis here in California. I think across the country, we have food banks, for example, in Petaluma, which is in the heart of wine country, telling us, you know, that they had overflowing lines, so they opened up two new sites, and within a day, those sites were full.
That's in Sonoma County. That's not in Watts or South Central L.A.
That's right. That's right. In Orange County, again, another very affluent community, people are reporting that folks are lining up 2 to 3 hours before the pantry starts. And this is, they're not walking home with, you know, a flatbed truck full of food. They're walking home with a bag full of food, and they're lining up for 2 to 3 hours in advance to do that.
How does your system of food banks interact with the government systems of supplementing the diets of the poor? I mean, how much do people depend on the government, and how much do they depend on your, I guess, private efforts?
Right. Well, you know, as much as food banks are needed and necessary to be there when people, you know, are hungry, we can't solve the problem alone. I mean, if somebody comes to a food pantry, they're going to get a 3-day bag of food, if they're lucky. You know, these days, because there are so many people coming to the lines and because food banks are struggling with resources, they might split the bag up even more so that everybody can get a bag, and so the bags might be smaller. So we can't do the job on our own. We are not the largest anti-hunger program in the country. In fact, the food stamp program is, and it's failing in our state with only 50% of the people who are eligible actually participating in the program. And yet, you know, the folks at the state and the counties are working very hard under the laws that they have to provide increased food stamps to people. It's just not working.
I want to ask about the pressure on this whole system in the current economic downturn. But I want to get a call here first. May have gone away. Well, let's get one from Susan in Walterboro, South Carolina. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, Tom. I work for DSS in Walterboro, South Carolina. A lot of people have no idea where that is. It's very rural. And we're actually seeing a lot of people coming in, and our funds have run dry. We don't have any money for them. We don't have any food to give them. So we had to turn to churches and ask them to donate food for us to have up at DSS.
And this is Department of Social Services in South Carolina. So to be sure I understand, is that state-funded, Susan?
Yes, that's state-funded. And South Carolina is not a rich state, and it's taking a lot of downturn. And since we can't afford to fire people, since there's so many more people coming in, they've just started cutting what we're offering people. We've just had funds completely disappearing.
Joel, there's another report from South Carolina, but this is not only a problem there when you look around the country.
Yeah, Susan, does your agency manage the state-level distribution of the food stamps program?
No, we don't. The food stamps. Yes, I thought you said food bank. Yes, we do. We work on the county level. I'm sorry.
Right. I guess, you know, first of all, thank you for the call, but I think this really illustrates part of the problem. You know, the food stamps program is a federally funded entitlement program. The school breakfast and school lunch program are federally funded entitlement programs. They are supposed to be countercyclical, which means when the economy goes down, more people can get them. And it's a little distressing to hear someone working in government at a local level saying food is running out and they're sending people to local charities, when I would hope local government agencies would be sending people to offices that can get them food stamps. South Carolina does have one of the highest rates of food insecurity in the country. In the 2005 to 2007 time period, 13% of the people in South Carolina lived in households that couldn't afford enough food. And this is an issue in all 50 states. We heard Jessica, my colleague, say that half the people in California eligible for food stamps aren't getting them. And that's why in my book I call for not just more funding, but really fundamental reform, combining existing nutrition assistance programs, reducing the paperwork, reducing the bureaucracy, and pumping that money back into benefits for low-income families. You know, I've never once met someone eligible for Social Security benefits who wasn't getting them, and yet we make food stamps benefits so difficult to get. Half the people in the biggest state of the union don't get them when people are going hungry. Something's very wrong with that program when that's occurring.
Susan, thanks for calling in. You know, Joel, Jessica, the thing I stumbled on there was we had a caller from a yacht club in Hilton Head saying, you know, I'm throwing – who worked in the restaurant there, I guess, saying I'm throwing out a lot of food every day. He wished he could get some of that great food untouched to our caller, Francis. Jessica, in California, what about this I mean, you're in the breadbasket, one of the breadbaskets of the country. It's not as though there's not a lot of food around.
Yeah, there is a lot of food, and food banks in particular here in California have been embarking on a new project over the last 3 years to address one of the issues that you and Joel were discussing earlier about not having access to good food. Here in California, we grow most of the country's food and in fact export to many, many other countries. And yet Californians didn't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables. So we started a project about 3 years ago to bring more fruits and vegetables to low-income Californians. And now we're distributing about 60 million pounds of fresh fruits and vegetables through the food bank network. And in fact, some food banks are distributing over half of the food that they're giving is produce, which is amazing. It's amazing turn of events for food banks that have traditionally just been giving out canned food or dry foods. It's interesting, though, you know, the flip side has come to us, which is that when people are going to food banks to supplement the food that they have at home already, it makes sense to give them produce and lots of it. But lately, people are coming to food banks for their sole source of food, and you can't make a meal out of a bag of apples and a bag of carrots.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to, you know, it's hard for us to figure out how to come up with the right basket of food. You know, our donation climate has been changing a lot. Stores and food producers are becoming more efficient, and when they're more efficient, they have less to give to us.
Joel, how do you see the impact of the economic downturn we're in right now? We've heard reports from California and from the Carolinas, but in New York nationally, what is the knock-on effect here on numbers, on the dynamics of getting food to people who need it now?
Over the last few years in America and here in New York City where I work, hunger has been an overflowing river. This year, it's truly a tidal wave. Last year, with the economy starting to go down, with government cutbacks starting to go into effect, things went from bad to worse. This year, with the economy truly in the tank and government cutbacks going into full force, things have really gone from worse to worser. I'll give you two sets of statistics. The 1,200 soup kitchens and food pantries in New York City served 20% more people in 2007 than the year before. This year, they served 28% more people than the year before. Last year, a startling 59% of the pantries and kitchens in New York City didn't have enough food to meet the growing demand, and they had to ration food, either turning people away, reducing portion size, or reducing the hours of the operation. This year, two-thirds of the agencies in New York City, still, despite the downturn, still the richest city in the history of the planet, two-thirds of the agencies were turning people away. And so while food banks and soup kitchens and food pantries have been doing truly heroic work, and Feeding America, the National Association of Food Banks, sort of the national association representing the state association that Jessica represents and food banks around the country, have been doing amazing work, not only increasing private donations, but really figuring out a way to do innovative things like getting people benefits, getting people fresh produce. But the model on which they're based can only do so much. They've had to start buying food. A larger and larger percentage of the food they're distributing is government food. So the idea, let's help the charities instead of government, is really a false distinction, because a lot of the charitable food being given out is government food. So the bottom line is they need more help, and we hope the new economic recovery package does have more money for food banks, food pantries, and soup kitchens. But that's not enough. We need to return to a time of living wage jobs and a really significant safety net so that people can at least afford to feed their families. Mm.
Let's get a call from Chase Mills, New York, and Cheryl. Hi, Cheryl. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you know, Cheryl?
I've been an outreach worker in Northern New York for 10 years now, helping people with emergency food and fuel, people who fall through the cracks of government-funded programs. And I do find more people than ever are needing help. I'm in the largest county in New York State with less people than cows. And we're in a farming community, and people here should not be hungry. Nobody should be hungry.
Is it a different profile of person who's needing food today than it was a year ago, Cheryl?
Yes. Last year, I think it started the most. We have working people who are struggling just to make ends meet, because when you're heating houses at 17 below zero and you're trying, you just need to eat to stay warm. And the food banks give them wonderful food. We have wonderful food banks up here. But sometimes I just need to give somebody a gift certificate and help them stay fed through a crisis, and then they can get help that they need through the government.
But you're seeing it right there. Thanks for your call, Cheryl. Jessica, what about the flow coming into your food banks in California? Is it you told us the story of the volunteer who's now a recipient, but is it a visibly, notably different population or changing population coming in for food assistance?
Yeah, it is. We had, you know, probably about 5 months ago, an email went around to the executive directors of food banks in California, where one executive director said, "Wow, I just saw a former donor in my line," and then, you know, over the next couple of weeks, you'd hear one or two more. Now people don't even bother sending those stories because it's so commonplace. You know, across the state, we're seeing increases. Everybody's reporting increases in need. 19% in 1 month, that kind of increase, record number phone calls, and yes, indeed, having to turn people away. I just, you know, if you can think about being the person, the last person in the line before the pantry coordinator says, "I'm sorry, we're out of food." Again, I have to, you know, say that that's just, it's an indignity that nobody in our country, and I would hope that in the world, and that's not what we're talking about now, but nobody should have to experience hunger.
Not like that. The last one in the line before the line gets shut off. And that's not where we want anyone standing, clearly. Jessica, no, I know we have to let you go, but I'm grateful to you for joining us. Jessica Bartholow, Director of Programs at the California Association of Food Banks in Oakland, California. Jessica, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks, Tom, for covering this subject.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about hunger in the USA and what to do about it. My guest is Joel Berg. He's executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger and author of the new book, All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America. We're going to look at some ideas for attacking this. Joel's got some big ones. Let me get a couple of calls here first. Michael in Nashville, Tennessee, you're on the air.
Hi, hello.
Hi, Michael. What do you know?
Well, I just wanted to point out, I'm sure that you're guest has probably already researched into this. The income limit for a one-person household for food stamps is $1,127 a month. That is to say that if you are making over that, then you are over income for food stamps.
So that's an annual income of about $13,000, not exactly big time.
Right. And in practical purposes, let's say you're paying $500 a month rent on an apartment. Maybe there's, if you're lucky, you know, $35-$40 a week, a week coming out for any kind of insurance.
Mm-hmm.
You've got car insurance and things like that. It doesn't leave much. And there's one thing I've noticed is that need does not necessarily translate into eligibility. And also I wanted to point out, too, that the maximum food stamp allotment for a month is $176 for one person, which also, it works as a supplement, but not necessarily something that you can, you know, like y'all were talking about earlier, I eat healthy on, you know?
Yeah, even in Nashville, you're saying, or wherever you are, I mean, that is a real stretch.
And I think, you know, corn syrup is cheaper than a lot of stuff. And, like, when you go in, if you want to go buy products that, you know, are healthy and things like that, you're going to end up paying more for it, and your food stamps are going to stretch less far than if you, buy a lot of, you know, potato chips.
Yeah, absolutely. Michael, thank you very much for that insight. Joel, Michael speaks softly, but he carries a big insight there. Need does not necessarily equal eligibility. What's the operating philosophy in this country on need and eligibility? I mean, are we committed formally to helping people who are hungry or not?
Michael's question is really excellent. America is ambivalent about social programs. On one hand, we're one of the most generous nations in the world. We don't believe Americans should starve, but we also collectively tend to believe that government should not play that great a role, and therefore we should make it very, very difficult for low-income people to get benefits. They shouldn't be too broad. They shouldn't be available to too many people. And in my book, I contrast that to the massive amounts of corporate welfare this nation gives out at the drop of a hat. So it's far easier if you're a huge developer here in New York City and a billionaire to get government aid to aid your luxury housing complex or your new arena than it is to get food stamps if you're a struggling family. Now, I can use Michael's question as a wonderful transition to one of my solutions.
Mm-hmm.
The eligibility guidelines are a mishmash. They are set to some ratio of the poverty line. So food stamps, you can make up to 30% more than the poverty line. The WIC program, it's 185% of the poverty line. School meals for your kids, if they're free, 130% of the poverty line. If they're reduced priced, 185% of the poverty line. And government-funded commodities through food banks and food pantries, it depends where you live. And often there's a different form, a different eligibility process, and a different government office you have to go to apply for these programs. So you can spend all day or all week going from government office to government office to government office in a Kafkaesque nightmare of applying for these programs. And depending on what your income is in any given week, you may or may not qualify. And by the way, if you increase your income by getting a job or increasing your hours or getting a slight raise, not enough to be even middle class, then you can actually lose all your benefits. That's why I've called for combining the programs into one program and increasing the income at which you can earn up to 85% more than the poverty line. So you're not going to be rich by any means, not even really middle class, but just a little more than the poverty line. And so poor families would not be penalized for working a little harder and getting a little more money, and they'd still get that extra food help. And by the way, it's a very conservative notion, but because by combining these programs, you would reduce bureaucracy, reduce paperwork, which conservatives like, and you'd reach the progressive goal of helping more low-income people. So I think it really is a win-win solution for the country.
So is that your primary push then? Not more emphasis on charity or food banks, but spreading the government program wider, higher up the income ladder so that more people are eligible? How many Americans would that make eligible for food assistance?
That would make tens of millions of Americans eligible for food assistance. I want to be clear. My very top answer to the problem is not expanding government food distribution, but increasing the number of living wage jobs that Americans have, improving public education, improving affordable housing, making child care available so that living wage jobs are more of a possibility for more Americans. But in this deep economic problem, I'm not sure that's a realistic, very short-term answer. So we do need a robust safety net. And I think pantries and kitchens and food banks should be the last resort, not the first resort. And that's how they used to be. They should go back to filling in the gaps, not being seen as a replacement for government. The truth is, trying to end hunger with canned food drives is like trying to fill the Grand Canyon with a teaspoon. All our great work won't get the job done. I run a nonprofit organization, the New York City Coalition Against Hunger. We desperately need donations. We desperately need volunteers. Food banks around the country should be supported, and all local charities should. But we should go back to doing what we do best, providing innovative services to individuals, helping do things more quickly than perhaps government might be able to do, filling in community gaps. But as long as nonprofits like the one I run are just treading water every day, providing basic services, and not even doing so adequately because we're running out, providing food, there's no way we can do what nonprofits do best. So I'm not saying government can do it alone, but government has got to take the lead. And if government does what it does best, grinding out what I call sort of McBenefits to the people who are eligible and creating economic opportunity, the nonprofits can go back to doing what we do best.
Mm-hmm. Barack Obama promised on the campaign trail to end child hunger in America by 2015. That's not so many years from now. Do you see the policy plans in his quiver to actually make that happen?
Absolutely, I do. And for all the horrible news we're talking about today, there is a bright spot. As I point out in my book, John Kennedy, in his first day as president, made an enormous difference, signed an executive order implementing a pilot program to start food stamps again that President Eisenhower had refused to implement, and signing an order to distribute excess food to hungry Americans. So we know a good president or even a great president on day one can make a huge difference. It is truly meaningful that President-elect Obama is the first president-elect in U.S. history, as far as I know, to have grown up in a family that at least briefly received food stamps benefits. He's also the first president-elect that I know of that has proposed a concrete plan to end child hunger in America. One other thing he's talked about, and I think is very doable very quickly, is expanding the availability of breakfast for children. One thing that we've done in New York City, and I also give Mayor Bloomberg credit for this, and the City Council credit for this, is we've started serving breakfast in pilot schools in the homeroom classroom. Nationwide, about 80% of the kids eligible for school breakfast don't get it. Some schools don't have it. In many schools, you have to come early, and it's a separate lunchroom. You have to go to breakfast, and kids sort of have to line up. Oh, I'm the poor kid. Mm. No one wants to be identified as a poor kid. So by serving it in the classroom, kids show up early. It reduces tardiness. It improves attendance and improves educational performance, all the while reducing hunger. So I hope a centerpiece of both educational policy and anti-hunger policy will be dramatically increasing use of school breakfast programs, and I think that's something that President-elect is committed to, and I think that's something that he could help the states and school districts do relatively quickly around the country.
Joel, what about American agricultural policy? We produce a lot of food in this country. How does the shape of our agricultural policy relate to this hunger food insecurity problem, if it does?
America has never, ever, ever had a shortage of food, even in the Great Depression. People sometimes think because we had the Dust Bowl in a number of states, we ran out of food. The truth is, even during the Dust Bowl, the greatest agricultural problem in America was overproduction of food, which made food prices plummet. So it's not a question of having enough food. It's a question of low-income Americans and lower-middle-income Americans having enough money to buy the food. Certainly, President-elect Obama has called for reform in American agriculture. He's called for limiting payments to $250,000 right now. It's possible to get millions and millions and millions, and sometimes even billionaires get agriculture subsidies, perhaps for land they've never seen. Certainly, there's a problem with our over-reliance on subsidizing large operations of just a few crops. Obama's talked about the problems with concentrated farming operations, animal-concentrated operations, so-called CAFOs, and he has actually proposed having the EPA do more to regulate their animal waste. And so taken together, along with proposals to really put the family farmer and the small and medium-sized farmer back at the centerpiece of American agriculture policy can really help. And my organization, the New York City Coalition Against Hunger, has put this into practice. Mm. We have a project that's buying fresh produce from small farms in upstate New York and distributing it for free through pantries and kitchens, and also giving it out at scholarship rates to lower-income people and allowing people using food stamps benefits to get this food. So I would hope the federal government in the next administration will do more to promote projects like that that are good for small farmers, good for the environment because these are organic farms, and good for low-income Americans and good for nutrition policy.
Let's get a call from Anita in Haverhill, Massachusetts. Anita, you're on the air.
I am. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to get back to the paradox of obesity and hunger.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if your guest has dealt with looking into high fructose corn syrup. And when you start reading all the labels in the supermarket, you find it's in most sodas, fruit juice, baked goods, snacks, junk food, and that this stuff has been found to contribute to diabetes, cardiovascular problems, and even obesity because it increases your hunger.
Sure. What's the answer then, Anita?
Well, I don't know. It's all over the place, and I'm wondering, is the government ever going to come out with the truth about it? There have been a lot of scientific studies,
yeah.
But are they going to be able to work against the lobbyists for the food company?
That works on policy fronts as well. Let me hold that thought and get one more call in a similar vein. Katie in Boston. You're on the air, Katie.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've worked in a food pantry in Ohio where I go to school for the past few years, and it's a huge problem. The people who come into our food pantry are, on the whole, really obese. And it's difficult because we do provide fresh vegetables grown in a local garden, but people tend to pick out the really high-fat, high-starch food. And you can tell that this isn't what we want to be feeding people, but it's also difficult to deny people who think that they're really hungry.
So what does that leave you thinking, Katie? You're working in the food pantry. Obese people are coming in, and of all the things you offer, they're picking the high-fat, high-starch. Where does that leave your thinking as a young person looking at this problem?
It seems to be a matter of sort of food consumption in this country generally. Obesity is a widespread problem, and it seems to be maybe a matter of regulation and what we're allowing ourselves to put into food, what we're getting addicted to, and ultimately what we crave. So
yeah.
I don't know what your guest has to say about that.
Let's look at the whole subject, Katie, and thank you very much for calling. We've got Anita there, Joel, saying, what about high fructose corn syrup? And Katie, well, you hear her story from the food pantry in Ohio. What do you say to this?
Well, I must say to Katie, my personal experience and the experience of people I've talked to around the country, volunteers at food pantries and soup kitchens, actually been different. Recently, I was at a farmer's market in a very low-income neighborhood of New York where people were lined up to pay actually their meager money to buy fresh produce. I've heard from pantries that have started incorporating fresh produce that people line up earlier to get the fresh produce. So maybe where you were, that didn't happen. But my experience around the country, if fresh produce is made available and affordable to low-income people, they want it just as much as higher-income people. There is another factor. If at the agency you were at, some of the people were homeless or were marginally housed, they may not have the cooking facilities they need to be able to to prepare much fresh produce for eating. Obviously, you know, you can eat an apple fairly easy, but broccoli, I don't think most people would enjoy eating it raw. And so then the other issue is, how much time does it take to prepare this? If low-income people are working one, two, three jobs, raising children, often without being able to afford childcare, and certainly not having nannies like yuppies might have, they might just not have the time to prepare fresh produce. On Anita's comment about corn syrup, yes, it is true. That is a major contributor to our obesity problem. And an issue that I hope the government can address someday is the ridiculous ways companies get away with labeling products. The most ridiculous thing is how they describe portion size. I once brought to a government hearing in New York three bags of pretzels which appeared to the naked eye to be about precisely the same, and yet one was supposedly one portion, one was supposedly two portions, and one was supposedly three portions. And it's ridiculous to say that a human being is going to open up this microscopic little bag of pretzels and then eat a third of it and put it away, and another day eat another third, etc. And people don't understand that if it says three portions and it says, let's say, 120 calories, then the bag would actually have 360 calories. So some of what we need to do is a little more equity in subsidizing corn syrup versus not particularly subsidizing vegetables, but some of it is making labeling clearer so people can make educated, informed decisions about what they're eating.
Joel, we literally have about 20 seconds. Does your work, do your goals have to wait until the other side of this economic meltdown, wherever that may be, or are these things that can be worked on, addressed now?
They can be done immediately. The economic stimulus package signed into law by President Obama on January 21st of next year can have a serious down payment on ending hunger in America.
Joel Berg is author of All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America, also executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger. It's a fascinating picture, and we're very grateful for your work on it, Joel. Thanks very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can read an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.